The God of Stage 2 has structured a hierarchical world, one in which you can appeal to the king or the judge. The struggle to bring in laws to replace sheer might divides Stage 1 and Stage 2. Although power exposes you to the temptation to trample other people's needs. To prevent this, we have a new god, an omnipotent judge, who threatens even the most powerful king with retribution if he goes too far. Every parent is aware of the phase in a toddler's life associated with the terrible twos when power dawns. The two-year-old who throws tantrums, coaxes, wheedles, and manipulates any situation to get his way is testing his ego boundaries. Exasperated as they might get, good parents realize that balance grows out of excess. Without the testing of limits, the ego would either be cowed into submission or lost in grandiose fantasies. From its first days, the ego finds that making things go your way isn't automatic. This contest of competing egos creates the drama of Stage 2. If you know yourself to be competitive and ambitious, it goes without saying that at some level you have given your allegiance to the god of this stage. Society rewards these traits so much that we tend to overlook their roots. The ego forms a bridge from the family, where your needs and whims are indulged, to the setting of school, where rules override your whims and many other children are taken into account. The ego is always tempted to return to the infant paradise in which food and love came automatically without competition. This fantasy comes to the surface in adults who believe that they deserve everything they have earned, no matter by what means. The fantasy of getting everything for me doesn't often come true. However, this isn't the time for the meek to inherit the earth. Stage 2 is dominated by a god who justifies strength and competition with no thought that being a loser is possible. The theme of Stage 2 can be summarized as winning is next to godliness. The Almighty approves of accomplishment. The Protestant work ethic sealed his approval into dogma. Those who work the hardest will get the greatest reward. But did this belief actually derive from spiritual insight? Or did people find themselves in a world where work needed to be done and added God's stamp of approval afterward? In Stage 1, the fall from Eden brings Adam and Eve the curse of having to labor until you return to the dust from whence you came. For work to be glorified now in Stage 2 seems contradictory. Yet this is exactly how inner growth proceeds. Each stage involves a change of perspective or even a new worldview. If we take the Bible as our authority, there is ample evidence to support the notion that God approves of work, competition, and winning. None of the kings of Israel is punished for going to war. In fact, most of the Old Testament victories require miracles or God's blessings to be achieved. On the other hand, Jesus is adamantly opposed to war, and in general, to work. The Sermon on the Mount is in favor of letting God handle all earthly needs. Do not store up for yourselves treasure on earth, where it grows rusty and moth-eaten, and thieves break in to steal it. Store up treasure in heaven instead. No servant can be a slave to two masters. You cannot serve God and mammon, money. This sort of talk was disturbing. In the first place, it undercut the power of the rich. Even if you ignore the letter of what is being said, society has found countless ways to serve God and money at the same time. Jesus doesn't equate power with achievement, work, planning, saving, or accumulation. All are necessary in order to build wealth, wage war, or divide the strong from the weak. These were the very goals that Jesus did not want to further. Therefore, his rejection of power makes perfect sense. He wanted the human wolves to lie down with the lambs. Stage 2 is much less paralyzed by fear of God than stage 1. But the next closest emotion to fear, awe, is much present. This new God punishes by the rules. Most of his rules make sense in broad outline. Every society mandates against murder, theft, lying, and coveting property that belongs to someone else. As long as the deity inspires awe, the way to him is through blind obedience. In this stage, the hidden question is, can God really make good on his threats? The Almighty has to make sure that no one is tempted to find out, which means that he must exhibit his strength. The righteous must receive tangible rewards. The wrongdoers must feel his wrath. For fear of hurting ourselves, we pull away from disobedience, even though we have never experienced divine punishment in real life. To this end, we take ordinary misfortunes such as illness, bankruptcy, and loss of loved ones and interpret them as coming from God. Obedience isn't an end unto itself. For obeying God's laws, the worshipper expects a reward. In stage 2, this takes the form of getting what you want. God permits you to fulfill your desires, and he makes you feel righteous in the bargain. In his role as Almighty, the deity now begins to answer prayers. In this value system, the rich can clothe themselves in virtue, while the poor are morally suspect and seem shameful. Measuring good and evil according to rewards has its pitfalls. The ego has to figure out how to aggrandize me, while at the same time being good. Rarely does the solution emerge as pure honesty and cooperation. As a result, manipulation is born. The goal of manipulation is to get what you want, but not look bad in the process. This calculus is very important if you fear that God is watching and keeping tabs. Are these simply the kinds of shortcuts we are all tempted to use in order to get our way? If you turn to the Old Testament, there is no mistaking that God himself is manipulative.